Okay, we have quite a lot in front of us today. Even with just narrowing to the one aliyah, there is so much. It's so much simply in terms of quantity. It is a very lengthy aliyah. But even without that, it would be huge. This is a very, very dense aliyah. One contains great tragedy for Klal Yisrael, an episode that we are still trying to live down and that we are still struggling with, the Chet HaEgel. And the Parsha overall is one of the most theologically intense Parshios in the Torah, so many themes that affect major principles of Hashkafa, of Tfilah, of Tshuva. One really could spend many, many hours talking about this Parsha and even just about this Aliyah. So we don't have many hours, and we don't even have only one Parsha, as we'll discuss, but there's a strong linkage between the two Parshios this Shabbos, as we will also try to explore. So we'll try just to address as many of the themes as we can in the time that we have. We begin on what seems like a hopeful note, that the Aliyah begins with Moshe being given the Luchos to bring to the Jewish people. So that should have worked out well. Vayitengel Moshe kechalos v'ladaber ito b'har Sinai shnei luchos aidus luchos aven k'suvim b'etzva elokim. So far you would think that's very good. So here Moshe is given the luchos that were written with the finger of God, and this is meant to be presented to the Jewish people. So here already there is a lot to note just in terms of the timing. Rashi highlights here the theme of Ein Mukdam U'Mukhar Torah, because the Chet HaEgel happened on Shabbat of Tammuz, and the Mechila came on Yom Kippur, and then they started the Mishkan afterwards. So here we have Parshas Tetzaveh before all this, so it seems this is a instance of Ein Mukdam U'Mukhar Torah, that story is presented here out of order. Some of the other Mephoreshim ask, why is that necessarily the case? Maybe the instruction in Parshas Tetzaveh, maybe that is all coming from before, and the story is being presented in order. So some suggest, and the Paris Yosef quotes from the Rabbi Reb Heschel, the author of the Sefer Chanukah HaTorah, that if we assume that there is a connection between this Parsha and what's referred to in Parshas Tetzaveh, the idea that the Baal Surim has, that the reason that Moshe Rabbeinu's name does not appear in Parshas Tetzaveh is because of what he says in this Parsha of Mecheinina Misifrucha Asher Kasavta, that you should be erased from the book that has been written. So that perhaps then suggests that that indeed took place first. So in any event, this is what Rashi writes, that it is out of order. And the symbolism of Kechaloso, that here when he finished speaking, so Rashi says it's written chaser in order to convey the symbolism of a kala, and that this is supposed to have been a happy occasion, the marriage kviyachol of the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and what this is supposed to represent. And this is a theme that will come up again and again. In the Sivas of Blazer HaGadol, he says that, therefore, that's why we're told that whoever is Mesameach Chasen Kala, it is as if he receives the Torah at Sinai. It's based on this reference. But, as we know, it did not work out as well as it could have sounded. Vayah ha'am, kivoshish moshul aredis minahar. Vayikoyel ha'am, Al Aaron, v'yomer elav, koma selanu Elohim, asher yelchol lefaneinu, ki zeh Moshe, ish asher ha'alanu me'eretz Mitzrayim, lo yadanu mahayelo. So here he was delayed. That's where Rashi understands the language of Boshesh. Lashon Ichor, Rashi writes. So that threw everything into a tizzy, as far as their mind. That here they got panicked and they got confused. And the idea of Boshesh, so Rashi tells us that it means delay. The Gemara tells us in Shabbos and Daf Beitas that Moshe was supposed to come back at 6 hours into the day. And that's what this language of Ba'ashesh is also meant to convey. And the Sutton instilled a panic and a confusion in the Jewish people that had these tragic results. And the Torah Tanima says the idea of the timing is that it's meant to be the time of the greatest publicity. And if that's the case, so perhaps there's a little bit of foreshadowing here also, because we're already kind of seeing that the imagery here of this Aliyah starts off hopeful and then all of a sudden takes a very bad turn. And Chazal tell us that the reason the second Luchos were more successful than the first Luchos is Ein Lecha Yafeh Min Atznius, that the first Luchos were given with such fanfare and it didn't end up lasting. And the second Luchos, given in a more tzanua way, so that does last. So here, if this is part of the theme of publicity, and that's also a part of what was connected to the tragic results here, so maybe there's a little bit of foreshadowing in that praising as well. So here we have the Jews then do this very dramatic reaction, and Aaron is helping them, which is something we have to try to figure out. But the Yomar Aleihem Aaron Parku Nizmei Hazav Eshem Ozni Sheichem V'Nechem Aseichem V'Yu Eloi. So you should bring me your jewelry, the jewelry of your families, the Sparku Kol Amis Nizmei Hazav Eshem Ozni V'Yu El Aaron. And they did that. The Yigas Miyadam V'Yotzer Osol B'Cheret V'Yasehi U'Egol Masecha V'Yomru Eilel Hachi Yisrael Asher Haluchu Me'aretz Mitzrayim. So they made it into an egel, and they said, unbelievably, that this is your God. So the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin has two different takes on the plural language here. On this Eile Elohecha Yisrael. So does that make it better or does that make it worse? And here this connects to the whole larger question, which we'll have to comment on throughout, the question of the nature of the Aveira here. Clearly the Chet HaEgel is a tremendous disgraceful episode in our past, but what exactly was going on, both psychologically and theologically and halachically? How could it be that they just, at this moment in time, when they should be on such a high, that they just turned to Avodah Zarah? The whole thing is so difficult. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin has two different takes on this plural language of Eile Elohecha Yisrael. So one makes it worse and one makes it maybe better. Now, one opinion is that it shows that they were always looking for a multiplicity of gods. That was the way they were oriented, that they were looking not to worship one god, but they were looking for a plural. And this really goes to the core of the whole Avodah Zarah instinct and the whole Avodah Zarah attitude, that the main theme of not being an Ovid Avodah Zarah is really monotheism, is understanding that there is one God who contains everything and who controls everything. And you don't pit forces against each other and say there's a good God and a bad God, that there are many different forces, and you'll worship this one to try to get on their good side against that one. So the whole connection of theology and morality and the notion of Avodah Zarah, so it really starts with the idea of monotheism. So looking for multiple gods is the real essence of Avodah Zarah in the fullest sense. And the other opinion has it a little bit more of a softer reading, that they weren't looking to reject God himself, but they were saying, okay, God has partners, what's known as Shittuf, which is a very major discussion in more recent centuries, because it goes to the question of how Christianity is understood within Halacha, and major discussion among the Rishonim and the later Poskim, that if one believes in our God, let's say, and when you have a total monotheism, so then it really just becomes a question of language in a certain sense. Obviously, the religions have all the details which are very significant, but the idea that the Rambam and other Rishonim had, that Islam doesn't constitute Avodah Zarah, at least not in that full sense, is because they recognize one completely all-encompassing God, even if they use different language and they have a different understanding of what his ratzon is. But as far as the Avzari Avera of Vodazara, so once you see there's only one God, so then there isn't so much room to go anywhere else. And that's why the question of the multiplicity is so significant. So then the issue of if you're Meshatef, God's essence with something else, with some other force, so what does that do to your concept of monotheism? It doesn't sound as dramatic as worshiping multiple gods, but it's not the same thing as just worshiping one god either. So how exactly that's classified, certainly completely wrong for Jews to believe in any kind of a sheetah, and that's a question of just how exactly to assess it. The question of whether it's a violation of the Isser of Vodazara for Bnei Noach, that's where the Rishonim had some discussion, had some debate, and that affects how you understand the concept such as the Trinity. So the Gemara and Sanhedrin has these two opinions on what to understand exactly from this double language. So in any event, so we have Aaron's involvement here, which we've already seen. This next pasuk says it again, Vayar Aaron, Vayivim Mizbeach, Ufanav, Vikra Aaron, Vayomar Chagla, Shemochar. So what exactly is going on with Aaron's involvement? Well, very hard to understand. Doesn't seem like something we would expect from him. So the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin on Daf Zayin, which has a number of points about the contrasting approaches and personalities of Moshe and Aaron, which is very much on display here as well. But the Gemara explains that part of what Aaron was thinking is that he saw they had already killed Hur at that point, and he was worried if they're going to kill him as well. And if they kill him, it's not just that he didn't want to die, but he, as the Kohen Gadol that he was in his mentality, so he was worried that Klal Yisrael would never be able to come back for that. So Pasuk in Eicha, that he may hurry the Mikdash Hashem, Kohen the Navi, if they would kill both Hur and him, he thought that that would be the point of no return, and Klal Yisrael would never be able to do tshuva. So this is relevant because it's relevant to a lot of things, but the question of are we saying that it was okay or it was defensible that Aaron was involved because he was afraid of being killed, and again, the fact that his fear of being killed was not just because of his own personal self-preservation, but also because of what it would mean for Klal Yisrael. So later on in this Aliyah, this very long, intense Aliyah, so we'll find the Pasuk of Aleph that Moshe says to Aaron, V'yomer Moshe al Aaron, Ma asalacha ha'am hazeh, ki heveso alav chata gedola. What happened? What did the people do that you were involved in such a action for them that has brought about such an avera? So Rashi says that what kind of a beating did they give you? What kind of pressure did they put on you in order that you would cooperate with this? But the Ramban over there disagrees with Rashi because the implication is that, okay, it's understandable. They were coming at you and they were hurting you and threatening you, so you cooperated. But the Ramban says it's Yehari Vayavor, that's not something that you can tolerate even if they're going to kill you. You're not allowed to participate in Avodah Zarah. So how could that be? That's not going to be an excuse. And his intent must have been to say something else. And maybe this was a part of just emphasizing how bad it was, and the Ramban also suggests that maybe it means that, you know, what did these people do to you that you got them in so much trouble that you helped them along in this terrible act, which is going to have such terrible consequences for them. So what did they do to you to deserve that you would take on such a guilt on behalf of the people, together with the people? So that's a big discussion. The Farshim have a lot to say about that pasuk and about Aaron's involvement in general. So the whole question of Yehari Vayavor is a important one. So was this an act for which we would say Yehari Vayavor, especially according to the Ramban? This is a question in of itself, because the question of the Ramban was Shitaso. The Ramban objecting that this is Lifneiver, that this is Yehari Vayavor, so as it's possible to point out, as many do, that Aaron was not worshipping idols himself. Aaron was not engaged in Avodah Zarah. What he was involved in was in Lifnei Iver of Avodah Zarah. We're not allowed to help out with Averos, Lifnei Iver, Lo Titen Nefesho. So he was involved in helping that Avera. So is that also Yehari Vayavar? That help with an Avera that otherwise itself would be considered Yehari Vayavar, an Avera that you're not allowed to do, even on threat of death. So does that rule apply even for somebody who's not committing it himself, but is helping? Is in violation of Lifnei Ivel or Sitei Mitchell? So that's a good question. It's actually a machlokas in the Rishonim and Sanhedrin, and there the Ramban actually takes the position that it's not Yehari Vayavar that helps somebody in a Yehari Vayavar Avera if you are playing an assisting role, an accomplice role of Lifnei Ivel or Sitei Mitchell, that's not itself Yehari Vayavar, and that's the way the Rama paskins in Shulchan Aruch. So what exactly is he getting at here is an interesting question. It could be that it's a machlokas in interpretation here, whether it should be Yehari Vayavar, but again, how to work out the Ramban l'shitoso is a problem. Some suggest that maybe it means that here is focusing on a different aspect, not the Lifnei Ivel, but the fact that it's a minor involvement, what we call Abizrayu. Maybe there are other ways of explaining it, but it's also interesting in further defense of Aram. So the Tzad that it wouldn't be Yehari Vayavar to help somebody in an act of Avodah Zarah, in an act of Vaticha. That's actually a very, very relevant contemporary question because it comes up a lot in medical ethics and contemporary medical ethics with some of the issues that touch upon Ritzicha and a doctor's involvement in them, and the question of whether it's Yehari Vayavar or not becomes very relevant, very, very practical, and has many nafkaminas. So what's the lumdus of the question of whether Yehari Vayavar applies to an accomplice also? If you're not doing the Aver yourself, but you're helping somebody else to do it, so is that Yehari Vayavar or not? So it probably depends. This is a big discussion in the Achronim. It probably depends on how you understand the nature of the concept of Lifnei Ivel or Sitei Mitchel. Now, does it mean, if the Torah says, not only should you not do an Avera, but you shouldn't assist an Avera, you shouldn't be an accomplice. So what does that mean? Does that mean that the accomplice is considered to have done the act also? And it's just like in American law, if you drive the getaway car for the bank robbery, so you are able to be charged with robbing a bank, even though you didn't go into the bank, you didn't take the money yourself, but you made it possible, so therefore you are a partner in the deed, so it's like you're doing it yourself. In which case we would say that maybe it should also be Yehari Vayavar, that if the one who's doing it himself is subject to a rule of Yehari Vayavar, then if the one who's enabling it is considered to have done that act too, so maybe it should be Yehari Vayavar for him also. But there's another way to understand this Lifnei, which is that it's not like you're participating in the act itself. It's only the one who's doing it who is committing the act itself. But the Avera of Lifnei Ivel is actually a ben adam l'chaveiro. That actually what the Torah is saying is that the same way the literal interpretation of Lifnei Ivel, that you shouldn't trip a blind person, you shouldn't take advantage of someone's weakness to harm them physically. So too spiritually, you should not trip someone up and hurt them. So it's an avera ben adam l'chaveiro in that sense, that you are causing someone else to suffer spiritually, to be subject to onesh, to whatever spiritual consequences by helping them sin. So if that's the case, it's bad, but maybe it's not Yehari Vayavar, because it doesn't mean that you're connected to that avera itself. The issue is how you are harming the avayan. So that same svara, which would lead you to say it's not Yehari Vayavar, so first of all, that's already a defense of Aaron to say, okay, so he didn't necessarily have to give up his life in order to avoid this, but then you could take it a step further and say it's an even more fundamental defense of Aaron, because the nature of Lifnei Ivel normally would be that you are hurting the person, you're hurting the sinner by getting them in spiritual trouble. But here we see that his whole reason for doing this was in order to preserve their opportunity to do tshuva. So he's trying to minimize the trouble that they're in. He's saying that if they're going to kill him too, then it'd be the point of no return. But if he can stall them a little bit, then they shouldn't kill him. So then there'll be the possibility of tshuva. So then it's the opposite of Lufnei Iver. He's assisting on one level, but as far as the svara of Lufnei Iver, if that's indeed the svara, so it comes to an even stronger defense of Aaron. So that maybe that's what's going on. Still have to understand the Ramban's comments on Chumash, but that maybe that's what's going on, that Aaron, first of all, wouldn't have been obligated to give up his life in order to prevent this, as Ramban Paskins, and that also, it was more than that, he wasn't even getting them in trouble, he was intending to preserve their possibilities for tshuva, so the whole logic of Lufnei Iver in this case, if that's the side I'd understand it, didn't apply. Make sense? I'm going to follow that. It's a little complicated. Ari?
If we're saying, granted, if you're saying that Aaron's intention was to help the Jewish people to maintain the possibility for the tshuva, I understand why that wouldn't be arguing all Yahweh, but if you want to take the side that says that Lufnei Iver isn't useful, by yourself participating in the sin of Avodah Zarah, isn't it still worse to enable millions of or hundreds of thousands of people to do Avodah Zarah? Isn't that worse than you yourself, just one person doing Avodah Zarah, versus enabling hundreds of thousands of people to do it as well? Shouldn't you draw a call to bummer that that's worth it?
You're saying without the sugi of Lufnei Iver, you're saying it's just compelling on its own. Saying, but without, you're not necessarily talking about the lumdus of Lufnei Iver and whether it is a Hervei Yavo or not. You're saying just logically, it would seem like it's a much worse Avera. And that's reasonable to say like that. In general, we do certainly find that parallel in terms of mitzvos and in terms of Averas. We find that a person who's machti, somebody Chazal say, is worse than somebody who kills him. And that in terms of positive things, when it comes to tzedakah, we say that gadol hama'asa yosef menosef, somebody who's able to bring about behavior in someone else, is greater when it's positive behavior than the person doing the avera itself. So presumably there is a lot of logic to that, although here, I don't think that's necessarily what's happening. The point is that this was the direction they were going in anyway, and he's trying to find ways to slow it down. So, it's one thing when you say that if somebody inspires people to give tzedakah, so then he's having an effect that's greater than the effect he could have by himself. But here, he's not the cause of this attitude, and he's not the one who is promoting it. What his involvement looks like, it's really a technical issue of Lufnei Iver, that, okay, he doesn't want this to be happening, he's not looking to provoke it, and he has good intentions, but should we worry that still, nonetheless, there's an act of Avodah Zarah going on, and he's a part of it. So if that's the case, we have to understand what's the nature of the Yisur of Lufnei Iver. Is it that as a participant or as an accomplice, it makes you a participant, the getaway driver or the bank robber? Or do we say, no, it's a different kind of Averis and a different kind of relation, which seems to be how we paskin. And it's a much longer discussion. I'd love to focus on Lufnei Iver overall because there's a lot of fascinating lumdus to say. But it also allows you to read the pasuk a little bit more in a unified way, because if you want to say that it's a idea that you are considered to be as you did the Avera, so then that changes the pshat of the pasuk, which is possible. It could be that there's a Mesorah Torah Shabbat Pes to understand the pasuk on a different level. But if we're understanding it as an extension of the literal reading, so then when it comes to physically tripping a physically blind person, so we understand what the issue is. And no one would say that, oh, if you trip somebody who's blind, then when he falls, it's as if you fell also. We understand that the issue is that you caused him harm through exploiting his weakness. So if we want to keep that shot consistent, which is not the only way to read the puzzle, but it maybe is the slightly more compelling reading, so it's all one idea of just exploiting weakness to cause harm. So then we can understand why it's not Yehari Vayavar. It's really it's a Ben Adam L'Chaveru, a different kind of Avera. And especially in this case where his end goal was to try to help, so then maybe it shouldn't be seen in that light at all. But there's clearly a lot to work with. And clearly Moshe is not happy. And, you know, this is all indications from the text is that this is complicated and that it's not something that we can see as absolutely good or absolutely bad. If it was absolutely bad, presumably Aaron would not have done it. And if it was absolutely good, so then we wouldn't have seen, sounds like we wouldn't have seen Moshe's reaction in that way. And we also know from later on in the Torah, we know from Parsha Shmini and the various indications, Chazal tell us that this was something that Aaron carried around forever. He had a very hard time getting past it. So all indications from the text is that this was complicated as far as seeing it as either Aaron's involvement, as far as seeing it either fully justified or fully condemned, is hard to take one side or the other. In any event, so just to continue with all of the many, many themes here. So, Kevi Ashkimu Mimacharot, Yalu Olos, Olos, Yagishu Shlamim, Vayeshu Ha'am Le'achol V'shasav, Yakumu L'tzachek. So then they get up on the next day, which we found that we're recently in Parshas Yisro, we talked a little about Mimacharot, and it's very strong, dramatic language of contrast. And they start behaving in a very disgraceful manner in how they worship this calf. And the pasuk says, "V'davar shel Moshe lech rei kishiches amcha asher haleisa me'eretz Mitzrayim." So God tells Moshe this shocking news that he should go down because your nation has done terrible things, has become corrupted. So this idea of Lech Rei, which has a tremendous symbolism, it's literal, but it also seems to be symbolic as well. He should go down, but also, as Chazal tell us, Reid Migdulasa, you should go down from your perch, so to speak. And Soloveitchik had a drash about this that was printed in one of the English volumes that came out a few years ago, that Malchus, that Moshe represents, the leadership, requires humility and the breaking down of the ego. So it says that there has to be at least some level of failure that you have to pick up and move with, and that this was Moshe Rabbeinu's instance of that, and that's what the Lech Reid represents. So just a comment for a few moments on the whole idea of what exactly this Chet HaEgel represents. We spoke about it a little bit a few minutes ago, but just say a little bit more about it, because clearly it's so shocking, and Rishonim, the Kuzari, and the Ramban, and the Rashbam, and others, they struggle so greatly with this, because here, at this point in history, specifically the Dor Dea, that left Mitzrayim, that they should stumble in such a major way is so hard to understand. As Or Chaim points out, the language of Asher Halucha, they really thought that this took them out of Mitzrayim. I mean, how could that be? So there's a lot to try to understand, and the Rishonim do struggle with the nature of the Avera, as we indicated a few minutes ago. Was it absolute of Avodah Zarah, or was it some kind of watered down of Avodah Zarah? Was it something in the middle? Rashi's inclination, like we said before, is that they really wanted to worship many gods, and that's where they were heading. The Ramban understands that, no, they were just trying to replace Moshe Rabbeinu. And some of the Rishonim note that they thought that Moshe was given divinity also, and that's what they thought they could replace. The Kuzari explains that they needed a physical manifestation in order to relate to, and that they understood that that was what Moshe was doing, to come back with the Luchos, was supposed to come back with some physical manifestation. The Netziv, commenting here and elsewhere, explains that the idea is it's not actual Avodah Zarah, but it's a specific Isser not to create any kind of intermediary between people and God. And that also could be relevant to understanding Aaron's involvement. He wasn't necessarily aware of this issue specifically. Had it been actual Avodah Zarah, maybe he would have responded differently. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rabbi Soloveitchik in that same drasha, they both expressed that there was a basic lack of faith here, that they thought that Moshe was dead, and they didn't know how they could survive, and they didn't really have faith in God to lead them, and they were creating now a whole different direction. And really, from psychological perspective, what pushed them into that kind of a action. That's what's being highlighted in those interpretations, as Yaakov points out. It was also what was involved with the Chet HaMeraglim and all of the different averas that kind of share this common core. The Gemara in the beginning of Avodah Zarah and Avdal and Midbeis, the Gemara quotes from Shua ben Levi, who we've spoken a lot recently, that says that Lo Hayu Ruyim Yitzchol also Maisa, that this wouldn't have happened except in order to teach the Jews how to do tshuva. And that's a difficult idea on a lot of levels, but we talked a little bit in the earlier parshios in Shmos about the whole question of Bechira Chavshis and how that impacted Paro and the Mitzrayim. So here to say that the Jews, that this was kind of destined to happen, that they fell into this trap in order to teach the idea of tshuva, the Gemara contrasts the Avera of David HaMelech and the Avera of the Chet HaEgel, the two different types of tshuva, the tshuva of the Rabbim and tshuva of the Yochid, so this was to teach the tshuva of the Rabbim. But to say that as far as a Bechira Chavshis angle seems very difficult. So the Mashal comments over there that it doesn't mean that they sinned because this was a part of the plan. It means that maybe they should have been saved, that they, whatever issue was pushing them towards this chet was there anyway, but maybe Hashgacha would have saved them from this, except that there is a value ludoros of understanding the whole notion of tshuva for the rabbin. The Oznayim Latorah, Lutzke Rav, adds to this whole discussion that even though the Jews had said Nasa v'nishma, but that didn't impact yet on the rest of the world. It only impacted on Yisro. And the whole rest of the world was still in a great sense of confusion. So the Jews had to be there to fix that and to show a clear path. And since they themselves were not yet able to fully have their message clear, so that's why it needed to be clarified at that point. So the Sultan was able to bring them to that point a little bit earlier so that it would be clarified. Again, it's still a very challenging idea. So, here, Moshe comes down and he's told, God tells him, Sora maher min adarach asher tzivisa, masul hem ego matzecha, v'yishtachavolo, v'yizbukolo, v'yomru elu hafi Yisrael, asher aluch meretz Mitzrayim, v'yomru asher Moshe reisi, as am hazeh, v'nei am kshe erach, who I see their people with great stubbornness, v'yato hanicholi, v'yicha apivu hev, v'achalein, So God says, so leave me alone, and I'm going to destroy them, and you, Moshe, I'll make you into a big nation. So first of all, leave me alone. What does that mean? When did that happen? So Rashi here says that is here before Moshe has started appealing on their behalf. So God's saying, don't bother, I'm going to destroy them. It sounds like from the Gemara Maseches Brachos in the Islamic base, which talks about some of the implications of this whole dialogue here. And this is, again, a part of the great theological intensity of this parsha, the dialogue between Moshe and the Kodesh Baruch Hu here and later Psukim, where there's going to be so much about the nature of arguing with God and davening and trying to understand His ways and trying to appeal and also trying to perceive His presence. That's why, again, the logical intensity of this parsha is really mind-blowing. So here, the Gemara suggests, it sounds like from the Gemara, that Moshe had already started davening, and God says, leave me alone, and Moshe says, no, I'm not going to until the Jews are forgiven. Nitziv suggests there's a distinction here between Bakasha and Tefillah in general, and that Hashem is telling him stop asking, but he's not saying to stop the Tefillah as a whole. So the next pasuk is the pasuk we're well acquainted with from the Kriyas HaTorah and Taneisim, where this is taken from. Vayichal Moshe at Tnei Hashem Elokav, Vayomer Lama Hashem Yechrabcha V'Amelcha Asher Hotzeitz Amerik Mitzrayim B'Kach Gadol V'Yad Chazaka. So Moshe basically makes a supplication to God and says, why should you have such anger against them? There are different interpretations in Chazal of what exactly Leichal could connote in addition to supplication, maybe to allowing one to cool down. Mara has a discussion in the sense of how often should one restart the whole process of tefillah. We also find the idea of Moshe, so to speak, playing a role in the Hataras Nedarim, so to speak, of God, and that's a fascinating path to explore, a lot to say about that. And the idea that we read this on a Tainus, and all of the instances of that, you have a lot of discussion as well. Mosefer Chavetzel Sasharim, he has a nice discussion about the idea of reading Vayechal on a Tainus, and he raises the question of, should we understand that as a representation of the Inyano Shel Yom, that this is the same way we lay on Moedim, the theme of the day, so that's what happens, and we should reflect that through the Kriyas HaTorah, or is there a part of the, is a part of the idea that we want to incorporate this in the Bakasha? So when we're fasting and we are asking for some kind of Yeshua, so we want to incorporate the notion of Moshe's tefillah as a part of the bakasha. So he notes there that in some svarim, in the Shuvas Chavos Yair, and also in the Ginas Saradim, so there is a discussion, if you have 10 people who are fasting, happen to be fasting together on a day that's not a calendaric fast day, then maybe they can lay in Vayichal also. There's a big discussion about this. So that suggests that maybe it's not necessarily Minyan Shul Yom, but that it is a part of the bakasha that we incorporate into the tefillah experience, especially in the case of a tainus. That's an interesting discussion in general, the whole notion of the relationship of the Kriyas HaTorah on a tainus and how much it's plugged into the tainus itself. Kibbe Eger has the tshuva, and others discuss the question of if you have a calendaric tainus and somebody is not fasting, so can you still get Meliah for that Kriyas HaTorah? So Vega was inclined to say no, so if there's a tshuva in the other direction. It also impacts Kriyas HaTorah on Yom Kippur in the afternoon. Vega raised the question, is that a Kriyas HaTorah for the Yontif of Yom Kippur, or is it for the Tainus? And Nafkamini thought for whether somebody who's not fasting could get an Aliyah or not. So the whole discussion whether that premise is true or not, but it all goes to this issue of Vayichal, and how exactly does that fit in to the Tainus observance? What exactly are we trying to convey? So just to say a few words, we're not going to be able to go through every pasuk inside here in this very long Aliyah, but to say a few words about the idea of the Shvira Saluchos, which then follows. So that's itself a shocking event, another shock on top of the shock. The Cheta Egel is shocking, and the Shvira Saluchos is also shocking. So there's a lot that's written about that. The Meshech Chachma and others understood that Moshe was worried that if they could deify the Egel, so they could take an object and turn it into a god, they thought, so then that could happen with the Luchos as well. So then he had to destroy the Luchos in order to prevent that from happening or to make that point. And the suggestion there is that that was also what's suggested by Leich Rei Migdalascha, that even Moshe himself could become a deity in their eyes, and therefore he has to also come down from his perch, so to speak. There are others who suggest, Rabbi Saladinsky has a nice essay about this, an essay from Mishkan Betzalel, that the whole theme that is discussed in many Svarim, we talked about it a little bit in some previous parshas, that there was a big difference between the first set of luchos and the second set of luchos, and that the first set wouldn't have required any Torah Shabbat Peh, would have had everything all there, easy, and would have been permanent, but the Jews clearly were not ready for that, and they weren't able to function in such a context, and he highlights also that if there isn't a melus, if there isn't work, and if there isn't a big effort that has to be expended towards it, so then there's going to be a downfall, there's going to be a yerida. So therefore, what the message here is, okay, this side of luchos is not going to work for them, they need a whole different kind of relationship with a different matan Torah, and hopefully that, they will be able to be more successful. The Medrash suggests that the symbolism we mentioned at the outset, the whole symbolism of chasana here, that Moshe was trying to help them by break the luchos, because the luchos was the kesef kedushin, and if they were ready, so to speak, in a marriage with a Kadosh Baruch Hu kaviyachol, so then this would be like an act of eshes ish that would have been really terrible. So if they weren't actually yet in the state of kedushin, so then it would be bad. It wouldn't be as bad. It wouldn't be as irreparable. The Sefer HaMakna and his Hakdama has a whole discussion of what exactly that means. He understood it was a kedushin al knai. The symbolism here leaves a lot to expound, but that's another possible approach. The Mefarshim are also troubled with here HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe what's happening, and he basically, in terms of breaking the luchos, he seems to wait for the photo op. Right? Why didn't he just leave him there? So, you know, he goes down to see what's happening, and then when he sees it, so then he breaks the luchos at that point. So he's waiting for the cameras, it seems. So the Mefarshim try to figure out exactly what was the process there, and the Sforno, the Masham, they understood that at first Moshe thought, okay, this is terrible, but maybe they could still do tshuva. There still is hope for them. But then when Bayaris and Mecholos, he saw the whole partying, he saw that they were happy about it, he saw that they were enthusiastic, so then he realized, okay, this isn't going to work, and he had to break it. He had to break the luchos in that kind of reaction. Sforno also says, a little bit later, an idea that's also another Mefarshim, the Abarbanel, and the Nativ, and the Akeda, that he was looking for the cameras. He wanted to inspire them to do tshuva, so he wanted them to see. It needed to happen dramatically in order for them to have the possibility of reacting. Yaakov Kamenetsky comments about that idea. He says it's a little bit difficult because it sounds like from the Psukim that he Davka got angry when he came down, and that was the reaction. So in the Gemara in Yevamos, it talks about this, and that's on the stage. Marsha has a comment over there, quoting from the Bala Sefer Ikarim, that Eino Dome Shmi Eliria, as you say. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him this, okay, so he heard about it, but then when you actually see it, so that's what evokes all the passion and the reaction, and that's why he only broke it at that point. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about that in a few places, actually, in the Igros Moshe, where he's very upset about this. He says that he doesn't think that that could be, because if Moshe had the Amunah that we know that he had, so then there's no difference between Shmi and Re'iyah, that he would have related to it as exactly as true as he saw it with his own two eyes when he heard about it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So to say that there would be any difference between him witnessing it and having heard about it from God, Rav Moshe in the Tshuva says that's very difficult. Even the emotional component, right? Even the fact that he knew it was true, but when he saw it, he felt it emotionally. Rav Moshe thought that was too difficult to understand the pshat here. It is pointed out, as I say, from Mishcha Shemin by one of the Rabbanim in England, where he knows so that the Dibros Moshe in Parshas Yisro, Rav Moshe is quoted as saying something more similar to that. But in the Tshuvas, he's very upset about this. In the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, it describes that the Luchos suddenly became heavy. And so it was kind of a natural reaction that the Kedusha left them, and they became very heavy, and therefore he dropped them. And the Ragashavar and a few others, they use that to explain why this wouldn't have otherwise been an Isser. That whatever Moshe was thinking, we normally say, Lo Sasim Kein Lashem Elokeichem, as opposed to Kempashis Re'e, that there is a prohibition of destroying holy things. So you can't destroy a Sefer Torah, you can't destroy a Siddur. Presumably you can't destroy the Luchos either. So the suggestion was that it just kind of happened naturally, and that was the result of that. The Malvin, he understood that at first Moshe thought that the Jews were just looking to replace him. Okay, so he didn't take it the same way. But then again, when he saw the Mecholos, he saw the dancing. So that evoked a different kind of reaction. It's also noteworthy that, again, there's so much in the Pesukim to talk about, but here the language, if you see when it talks about how many people were involved, So if you count the numbers, so see that it's actually not that many people. So Shloshes Alfei Ish, as Mario Diskin and others point out, that that's basically 0.5%. So what about the other 99.5%? So wouldn't they have been able to overcome them? Wouldn't they have been able to stop them? So the Mario Diskin explains that he thinks that no one actually knew what was going on, which was a very important insight, that everybody was choshed everybody else. Basically, everybody thought that they were also a part of this group, and that even though it was only a very small percentage, nobody really had faith that that was the case, and therefore they didn't take any action, which is an interesting mentality that we see in many cases, that's something to reflect upon. Vitaly Dinsky in the Mishkan Betzalel, so he suggests that the idea here is that they just didn't want to get their hands dirty. And that's an idea we'll come back and reflect upon in a few minutes, that there wasn't enough of a communal concern, and that, okay, 0.5% was doing this, and the 99.5% could have stopped it, but they weren't invested in them. They didn't feel a need to. And that may have relevance to some other ideas that we'll come back to in a few minutes. So, in any event, we have here a lot more, Vahimi Mocharas, once again, that kind of dramatic language, Pasuk Lamed, and Moshe goes back to God and to Davin on their behalf. And the Pasuk Lamed Beis, the famous Pasuk, V'ata and Tisach HaTosam, V'imayin Mecheninah Misifrecha Asher Kasaf, so please you should forgive them, and if not, wipe me out, if not, take me out of the book that you have written. So this is the great godless, among one of the many examples, the great godless of Moshe Rabbeinu, that he had such personal self-sacrifice, that he was ready to give up his whole role here in order to protect the Jewish people. And this is actually highlighted as the greatness that Moshe had more than Avram Avinu, and what Avram had more than Noach. That we know Noach is criticized by Chazal all the time for his lack of impact on the people around him. And he was saved, okay, and nobody else was, outside of his family, and Avram was greater than him, because Avram was told that Sodom was going to be destroyed, and he davened on their behalf. And Moshe is the greatest, that here the Jewish people are looking at destruction, and not only is davened on their behalf, but he says, Mecheninah Misifrecha. So that is a big statement of his heroism here. And in fact, the Arizal suggests it was a tikkun of Noach, that Noach, who's blamed for the flood on some level, you see Chazal had such a negative attitude towards him. I think we spoke about that a little bit, Parshas Noach, at the beginning of the year. But the one clue in Torah Shebichtav that Noach had some kind of achrayas for what happened in his generation is that the Haftorah from Sefer Yeshayahu, the Haftorah for Parshas Noach, refers to the flood as Mei Noach, as the waters of Noach. So you could say it's the wrong way to call it. It's, you know, it should be called the waters of everyone but Noach. Noach was the one who survived. So the Pasuk seems to be associating with, seems to be blaming it on him, and that's the idea many have, that he was guilty for not doing more to reach out to or to daven on behalf of the people around him. So the Arizal suggested that this pasuk is the tikkun, that here Moshe was metaking on some level what Noach was lacking, and that the letters Mecheni are the same letters as Mei Noach, and that that represents a spiritual repair for how Noach was lacking. And the idea also that this represents the, and what the Baal Turim said, that's why he's left out of Parshas Tetzaveh, that even though it was successful, that it seems like he doesn't have to be erased because his prayer was accepted. But when a tzaddik says something, so on some level there's going to be a kiyum. And therefore, he's erased at least from that one parsha. So it sounds like it's a punishment, like he should be careful the way he speaks. You see, it had at least a little bit of an impact. But I think we could understand that really it's a big covet to him. It's kind of an acknowledgement of his self-sacrifice and of his great leadership. But at least b'miktsas, it should be mekuyim, but at least there's that one parsha in the Torah that doesn't have his name in it to show that this was the sacrifice he was ready to make and ultimately didn't have to make it. But at least there's some hint of it. There's one little instance of that in the absence in Parshas Tetzaveh. So we have so much in this Aliyah and so much in this Parsha, but it's not all that we have this Parsha. We also have Parshas Parah. And it may be especially appropriate that we have Parshas Parah this Shabbos. It's often the case that Parah is linked with Kisisa. And there is a special role that might be playing. You know, the idea of Parshas Parah is one of the Dalai Parshios, and we would imagine it's a Darabanan. But there are some Rishonim who understand that Parshas Parah is Daraisa. We talk about Parshas Zachar, and we talked about the questions of understanding that as a Din Daraisa, and talked a little bit about the whole progression to that, and many understood that that's the only time laning is Daraisa. But there are some Rishonim, when talking about the notion of lanings of Kriyas that could be Min HaTorah, that they throw in Parshas Parah. You find that in the beginning of the second Parak of Brachas. You find that in a few places in Rishonim, where Parshas Parah is mentioned as a possible Din D'Oraisa, and the Shulchan Aruch quotes that opinion as well. So it's hard to know. Where does that come from? Where do you find in the Torah that when it comes to Amalek, so we know, Zachar as Asher Asalach Amalek, but where do you find the idea that there is a mitzvah of Parshas Parah? So there are various suggestions. The Meshech Chachma understood that it's because of the notion of the Zartimus Mitzvah Mitzumasam, that you have to separate the Jews from Tumah, and you have to teach them about Tumah, so therefore Parah Aduma and its whole role in the Torah process is a way to do that, especially as we anticipate the Korban Pesach, which is part of why we do read it here. So therefore, that's the mitzvah in the Torah to make sure the Jews understand about the whole issue of Tumah. The Aruch HaShulchan points to the fact that the language of the Parah Aduma reading suggests that it should be for all generations. And we know that we haven't been involved in Parah Aduma for a long time now, and we have an idea of Neshama Parim Sloseinu, that we should talk about things that we're not able to fulfill, that is a kiyum in the mitzvah like we find by the Karbanos, so maybe that's the idea. We have to lane about the Parah in order to make it something that's applicable in our day as well. But there's another very interesting idea which I think is particularly relevant always, especially when we have the linkage that we do, that there is a mitzvah of Zechira. We have a few Zechiras, so we talked about Amalek recently, and we've been talking about Yisias Mitzrayim the past few weeks, and we talk about Shabbos, so there's a handful of mitzvahs of Zechira. Most count six, although there are different ways to count, probably anywhere between four and nine. But one that doesn't seem to have a practice is a pasuk in Parshas Ekev, which says, Zachar al tishkach et asher hitzavta et Hashem lokecha b'midbar, that we should remember how we angered God in the Midbar, which presumably is a reference to Egel HaZav. There's some who understand it differently, but it sounds like it's a mitzvah to remember the Egel HaZav. And the Ramban, in his commentary there, and also in his Sagas to say for a mitzvah, the Ramban writes, it's a real mitzvah in our Torah. We have an obligation to remember the Egel HaZav. So how come we don't ever do that? We don't have a Shabbos Parshas Egel like we do with Parshas Zachar. We don't make Kiddush about the Egel. We don't have any kind of kiyum of how we remember the Egel. So there's some who say that, well, nowadays, Magen Avraham says like this, they're thinking nowadays, since we lay in the whole Torah every year, so we have it fulfilled that way, and because it's such an embarrassing episode, we'd rather forget about it, but we have to remember it, so we can't. But it's not like Har Sinai or Shabbos, where we're happy, or Yetzias Mitzrayim, we're happy to make a big show out of it. Here we kind of want to do it as minimally as possible because it's such a disgraceful episode. But there are some who suggest the Malbim and the Shuvas Arugas Haposem and a few others that the idea is that we can make a shidduch here, that we have, on the one hand, this mitzvah doesn't seem to have any kiyum, and we have a halacha that we don't know what the source is. So we have the mitzvah of Zechiras Ha'egel, and we have the idea that reading Parshas Parah is the right, so we don't know where it comes from. So maybe we can make a shidduch between those two. And that the idea is that the reading of Parshas Parah is the kiyum of the mitzvah to remember the Egel. And the imagery that Rashi quotes over there, that Parah Aduma is the kapara for the Egel Hazav, and that the imagery of the mother and the child, the Egel is the child and the parah is the mother, Yavo Ha'ein, let the mother come and clean up the mess of the child. So we remember the kapara through the Parah Aduma. So that is especially appropriate when they two come together right after each other, when we have the reading of the Egel in Kisisa, and then right away we fulfill the mitzvah of Parshas Parah, so that's a very appropriate linking. It really fulfills that idea. And we can understand on one level why this should be, that if we understand why is it that we have a mitzvah to remember the Egel, we want to be mevazer ourselves, we want to try to embarrass ourselves, why should we have such a din? So presumably it's for the purpose of telling us that tshuva is possible, that we should remember that it's possible to come back. So therefore the notion of focusing on the kapara, focusing on the parah aduma, is a more positive way of not depressing us, but inspiring us with the possibility of tshuva and kapara. So it makes sense that Klal Yisrael would pick this. But it's also interesting that there's another possible angle why it is that we're supposed to remember the Egel. It's not just about tshuva, but some understand that it's there to warn us that it's always possible to stumble, that even the Klal Yisrael at such a great stage of accomplishment, the time of Matan Torah, could still stumble and engage in Avodah Zarah. So we should know that we're never secure and that we should never rest on our laurels, but understand that we're obligated to always have the zehirus, to always have care. So if that's the case, so does it still fit? Is there still a parallelism here between Parah Aduma and the idea of the Egel Hazav? So I think yes. I think that if we think about, you know, the famous paradox, right, the whole challenge of the idea of the Parah Aduma, that it is at the same time is able to be Metayer and Metame, that it can bring Tuma, it can also bring Tara. So how could that be, and the whole issue that everyone struggles with? So perhaps part of the message here is that there's no externality that's absolute. There's no externality that's going to do all the work for you, that it's always going to matter where you're focused and how careful you are, and that any tool, no matter how holy it is, could also be an instrument of Tuma. It could also be the source of downfall if you're not careful. And that therefore, just like we weren't careful at the time of the Egel Hazav, so the Parah Aduma is a positively framed reminder of that, and therefore that also becomes very crucial. Vital Radinsky, and that point we said before, so he suggests also that if the idea that the Egel Hazav represents an Aveira, not just on the ones who worshipped it, but on the vast majority of Klal Yisrael that didn't stop it, and they weren't willing to get their hands dirty, and they didn't really feel that kind of achrayus, so the Parah Aduma is a kapara in that sense, because here you are willing to risk Tumah in order to bring Tara to someone else, it is in that sense a very strong kapara. So there's a lot to think about with all this. But there's a lot to think about in general right now, and this has a lot of personal significance. I'll tell you, sitting here in Bergen County, this is the week, the first week a year ago, that we didn't lane in shul, that we didn't come to shul, that the shuls were closed for the first week, Parshas Kisisa, Parshas Parah, last year, and it was, and we're still very much in this challenge, but then it was a new challenge and a very, very surprising and scary moment to have this kind of unprecedented in our lifetime step of not going to shul. And on one level, perhaps it also does represent this idea that we have to see that the same way we have to be careful with everything. And we think, okay, shul is always a good idea and everything is always, it's always holy, and therefore there couldn't be any harm. We have to still have that attitude of zehirus and recognize when sometimes we have to have a different kind of attitude. And the parasha also tells us, "Lo yehavam negef b'fkodosam," that when they count together, we used to have to be careful to avoid a magefa, and that was the mentality that we had at that time, going into this unfortunately still relevant magefa of the situation that we're in, and that sometimes that means thinking in a very different way, and that was a major part of it. But it's also in a more positive sense, and I also speaking personally, because this is relevant to my shul, but it's was something that was very powerful. So when we were eventually able to come back to shul several months ago, so we took on the project of making up the parshios that were lost. And that we followed the plan that Reshefta laid out, that we started at one point adding two or three parshios a week at the end to make up the parshios that we didn't lane when the shuls were closed. And even though Poskim had different attitudes towards that, but all Poskim agreed it wasn't an obligation, but it was still something valuable to do, as Reshefta understood at least, that make up the parshios that we weren't able to lane at the time, and to do that. So we started this, it was Parshas Ekev at the time. And so following reading Parshas Ekev this past summer, we then made up Kisisa. So there it's really striking, because Parshas Ekev is when this whole story is reviewed, and when we read about the shattering of the Luchos again in the Chet HaEgel, and that language of the mitzvah to remember that we shouldn't forget about the Chet HaEgel is then. So we read Parshas Ekev, and then immediately read again, right after it, Parshas Kisisa, where the story originally is. And it just brought to mind that normally we have that mitzvah of remembering the Egel, and we try to do it in a more positive way by reading about the Parshas Para and the Para Aduma instead. And this past year, we didn't get to read Parshas Para on that Shabbos and to link it with Kisisa, as God willing we'll do this Shabbos, but we ended up linking the mitzvah as it's read in Parshas Ekev with the actual recounting of the story in Parshas Kisisa right away, without the kind of sugarcoating of doing it with the Parshas Parah. But perhaps that linkage is still something that can be very inspiring, and the idea especially that we didn't let the parshas get lost, and that even if the luchos have to be smashed and they have to be pushed away, and as the Gemara says, paimim shebitulo shel Torah hi kiyuma, that sometimes the Torah has to be neglected, to say it mildly, in order to allow it to survive, and we had to close the shuls that week of the original reading of Kisisa and Para, but we're not going to let it keep us down, and that we were going to be committed to make up those parshios and to, as a voluntary act, to make sure to show that we are very passionate about God's Torah and about making sure that we fit it in, whatever it takes. So that linkage then of Ekev and Kisisa should be a source of inspiration, should be a source of chizuk, and so too this week, as we unfortunately are still very much in this pandemic situation, but we're looking at a light at the end of the tunnel, and we're hoping that all of our tefillos and all of our commitment and all of our efforts to make sure that we don't let anything keep us down will bring us through the situation. So now to hopefully be able to lay in Kisisa and to lay in Parshas Parah, and the positive spin that Parshas Parah puts on Kisisa and puts on the destruction of the Luchos and the Bitul Shel Torah that should lead to Kiyuma, should be a source of bracha and merit for the entire world and for all of Klal Yisrael, and that all of the temporary Bitul Shel Torah of this past year should lead to a greater Kiyum and to a enduring, lasting effect of all of our learning and our davening. So I wish you a safe and healthy and inspiring and elevating Shabbos, and I look forward, God willing, to seeing you on Sunday.
Thank you.
Should know only good things.